Ellen, would you like to introduce our guest?
I sure would.
I believe
would.
He even has a PhD. No?
That,
you don't?
No.
He's not that good a guest. Sorry.
Listen, I think it's going to be very interesting. It's Peter Watson is here. Hi, Peter. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
And he's an architectural historian.
Yeah. And where did you get the credentials as an architectural historian?
I attended the preservation program at Columbia.
Oh, hey. So, yeah, well, he doesn't have a PhD, but he went to Columbia, as did you, Ellen Thurston.
I did. That's an extremely good program, though. Very prestigious.
Is it?
To have gone to that.
I knew people in the University of Virginia one, which was a good one, too, right? Is that a known one?
Yeah, University of Virginia and Penn and Columbia. Columbia is the first, and, you know, we're not biased. We think it's the best, so.
But they specialize in historic preservation.
Yeah, it's the first in the country.
So do you take, like, courses in old bricks, stuff like
you
that?
You can take whole courses in bricks and in concrete.
There are many different kinds of bricks.
There are.
Oh.
And the way in which they're laid.
And many different kinds of mortar. That's an entire subject into itself as well.
So you're here because, tell them, Ellen.
I was about to.
Well, I'm giving you a little prompt here.
Peter is also a board member of Historic Hudson.
Oh, that organization.
They are the stewards of the Dr. Oliver Bronson House.
Okay, full disclosure. My wife is vice president.
Vice president?
Yes.
Wow.
She's in charge of vice.
I didn't know that. But I met Peter when he gave a lecture, was it last week?
Yes, it was.
At Stair Gallery, under the auspices of Historic Hudson and the Columbia County Historical Society. Mm-hmm. And I forget what the title of that lecture was.
The title was Picturesque Transformations. And really what we were talking about was a series of projects by the mid-19th century architect A.J. Davis that involved a reinvention of an existing house and landscape. And the Bronson House that you just mentioned was one of them. And we also talked about Montgomery Place and Blythewood on the where Bard College is right now. And they were picturesque transformations. I was using that title because they were connecting back to the 18th century English picturesque tradition. This was a very self-conscious effort by the architect and his clients to kind of adapt that tradition, those ways of arranging buildings in the landscape to America, to the Hudson Valley, to the Hudson River, to everything it meant to be American.
What are the essential characteristics of the picturesque in landscape and housing design?
Oh, I don't think we have nearly enough time to talk about
just
that.
A couple of the highlights.
I think
there must be a kind of aesthetic principle at the core.
There are lots of aesthetic principles at the core. I mean, irregularity and variety and intricacy are some of the watchwords. There's a real, the whole theory of associationism. So really to think about a landscape as a picture, as a painting, to kind of compose in that way, and also to connect it to, emotionally and romantically to Gothic castles and ancient temples. It's an emotional tradition as well.
So it draws on a wide range of precedents in terms of design, not just, I mean, when you say Gothic as well as.
I think the thing that's interesting is there are lots of different kind of architectural styles in the mix, but it really is about how you use them. It's really about making them sort of subordinate to this larger whole. And really what you're doing is creating an overall environment that might have a Greek temple in one corner and a Gothic castle in another.
And isn't the view from the house or wherever you're standing on the property is important, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very much about locating the visitor, the spectator, thinking about how they approach the house, thinking about how they experience it, what they see. You know, are there trees in the view? Do you get the river? Do you get the house right away? Do we hold back? There's a lot of kind of stage work, essentially, stage direction.
It kind of comes to the thing about the artist being an architect or an architect trying to be an artist.
Yeah, we had a little bit of fun with that. I mean, there's a new exhibition opening at the Thomas Cole National Historic Site across the river. in celebration of the new studio, which Thomas Cole, the painter, designed. And that exhibit is called Thomas Cole, the Artist as Architect. And I was in a sort of similar vein, kind of making the case that Davis, who knew Cole right from the beginning, they're part of the same group of people and artists working in New York, was the architect as artist, and showed a lot of views. I don't think that many people had seen of watercolors that he had done for these projects, which were really part of the way he composed. I mean, he called himself an architectural composer, and painting really was how he conceived of his ideas and represented them. And what's interesting when you look at the working sketches is he's kind of working on paper directly often at his clients' houses. So he's sitting there on the veranda and kind of, you know, composing views and thinking, okay, let's move a tree here and let's add a temple there and a shore seat. And so kind of looking at his working sketches, you really get a sense of how he did it.
Hmm.
Now, as a architectural historian, you advise on how people restore or how groups restore buildings? I mean, what is it you actually do?
Yeah, so what is it I actually do? I mean, I think that's a fair question. Sometimes I'm actually operating as a consultant, generally to historic sites that are, you know, national historic landmarks like the Bronson House or Lyndhurst down the river.
Do you have to be certified in any way for that?
There's really not a certification. Yeah, okay. Like anything, you know, there's a degree of professional training.
Sure.
But in many cases, I just like working with old buildings. So whether I'm doing it as a consultant on a paid basis or more often than not as a volunteer on a board, really working to help take care of buildings, you know, to preserve them, to restore them, to learn about them. Those are the kind of things that I do.
You're also a trustee of the Shaker Museum in New Lebanon.
Yes.
That's a big project, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's a wonderful site. I mean, it's a huge site.
It was the roundhouse that had to be restored, right? Or the one that wasn't
the
barn, a building?
The stone barn.
Yeah, the big project has been the Great Stone Barn over the last few years. It was about a $2 million stabilization. This is a 200-foot long masonry barn, which tragically burned in 1972, and really took about a decade to put the $2 million dollars of financing together, and then more recently we've been able to get another $500,000 grant to cap the tops of the walls with lead. So and we're really hoping in the next year or two to get it floored and to be used as a performance space. And since the Shakers dance, I think that would be appropriate to have some dance in there. So that's one of the buildings there. But there are actually 11 different historic buildings, and there's 90 acres. Mm. So there's just, you know, a lot to deal with. And,
yeah,
and thinking about how we can bring more of the museum's collection and programs to the site is definitely a big part of the conversation as well.
Well, that lecture that you gave last week, which was fascinating, really, because you learned even the books that A.J. Davis was reading and the things that influenced him, I thought it was really interesting.
Who were his major influences?
So, I mean, he was a very voracious reader, like many Americans of his generation. He was largely self-educated. He loved the classics as an architect, all the things like Stuart and Rivette and Palladio, and, you know, he had access to them because his early partner, Ithiel Town, had the largest library of those kind of books. There were 11,000 volumes by the time he died. So that was one source. And then for this picturesque work that I talked about, a lot of them are English books. There are people like Uvedal Price and Richard Payne Knight and Archibald Allison, who are all kind of major theorists.
Mm-hmm.
And then really the one I really concentrated a lot on, because as I looked at the books, you could see the plates in the books that he was using as design sources. And he really talked about it in his diary. And that's Humphrey Repton, one of the famous landscape gardeners.
Did he put any marginalia in the books?
He did sometimes, yeah actually.
That's,
I mean, things that are from the New York Public Library, and he little scroll that says A.J. Davis, it's his copy, and in seven volumes. The books are a great way to understand him, and I think the thing I really love that's available now is all the digital, you know, that you can find these things online.
Google
They're
books.
Free, it's Google Books, and read the original and look at the plates and hear those voices, those, you know, kind of 18th century voices some of them remarkably modern, and some of them just you really wouldn't want to be in the same room with them.
I've always thought that a great project that Alana could do, since Church's library is there, they could have a website that not only lists the books, but have links to all these Google books, because they're all pre-20th century books, and they'd all be, you know, in the public domain.
Yeah.
But it takes money, too, I guess. But don't get me started about Alana. I don't even like the way they store the books there. They put rubber bands around them with a piece of paper. It's just absurd. Some crazy archivist told them that's the way to do it. Anyway, you have no involvement with Alana, I take it, or do you?
I know the people there. I love visiting Alana, and I love to seeing what's been happening with the landscape in particular for the last few years with Mark Przeworski and company.
Oh, yes.
Right.
Mark's been on the show a number of times.
So that lecture, the other lecture that's happening when?
It's going to be in Kinderhook, right?
So, yeah. So this is a very small series.
Oh,
it's
March
really,
12th.
It's a series consisting really of part A and part B. So part A was last weekend. That was about A.J. Davis, and it was about the Bronson House in the context of these other projects and really talking about the picturesque era. And really the next lecture, which is going to be in Kinderhook at the school, Jack Shainman's gallery, which is, I think, a really great place to to talk about this subject. It's just really going to focus more on the earlier period, on the federal period, because the Bronson House, and we call it the Dr. Oliver Bronson House and Estate, and that's a bit of a mouthful because that's what it says on our, you know, landmark designation, and so that's sort of the official title. But the house really is a hybrid. It's a combination of a house built for Samuel Plum in 1812 with these kind of later layers, and so sometimes people call the house the Plum Bronson House, and we're really talking about that earlier house. Which is attributed to a builder called Barnabas Waterman, and there's a, you know, he's a very elusive character, but a very interesting one, and he's actually sometimes attributed as the designer of the Plum House, but also the James Vanderpool House in Kinderhook. And really, what we're trying to do is look for ways to link these two, really the flagship historic. Houses of these two organizations. So it's a way to collaborate. It's a way to sort of think about the two houses, the Bronson or the Plum House and the Vanderpool House.
Now, when you're storing these buildings, I remember when the Bronson House was open for display recently and you were there, and I believe you were the one who was showing all the different stages of paint used.
Yeah.
So when you're doing a restoration, I imagine there's no... there's no sort of ideal form of the house that you're restoring. I mean, you can't say that at one point it was exactly this for, I mean, there are so many layers and things being done to it over time that a lot of decisions have to be made about what to pick, as you made clear with the paint choices.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, you know, people think of a restored house, particularly like a house museum. They think of, okay, it's all prettied up now. We painted it and we repointed the chimneys and, you know, did all the work that was involved. And that's what it always looked like. But really what you see in any house when you really get close to what happened to it over the years is it's not a fixed object. It really is, it's almost curated, you know, in the sense that you have old parts of the house and the owner chooses to keep them and then new parts they introduce and then maybe they might, you know, reassemble or reuse part of the original fabric.
The follow-up question then is when you're involved with the restoration, how do you decide what additions, renovations to keep and what, I mean, I'm sure there's some people who'd like to go back to the beginning and say the original house is what it should be.
Sure. And I don't like that paint color and don't you dare paint that color. No, I hear you.
But, you know, some additions were made also historic, you know, in a given time period and reflect something interesting, say 50 years later.
Yeah.
Still much before our present time.
Sure.
How do you make those decisions?
Well, I mean, the first thing I'd say is the decisions you make as a homeowner are somewhat different than the decisions you make, you know, if you're a historic site and you're truly trying to tell a story. We typically focus on a period of significance that said, you know, this house is important because these things happened in this era. And so we really want to collect and interpret and restore that period. But the later layers are important. So it really is a decision that involves, you know, two or three different things. So it is, you know, what is your period of significance? One is, what condition is it in? And can you afford to restore it? Or is it so deteriorated or changed that even though it's an interesting later layer, it doesn't exist? And it just, you know, how it fits into your programming. Is it good to have that building or that room that was put on in the 1920s in the back, even though it's not particularly interesting from an architectural or historical view, but it's a good place to put all the, you know, your files. So I think it really is,
right.
It's kind of a
certain sense, certain things you have to do just to make the house usable if it's going to be used. And that's what I noticed with the Cole studio. I mean, a large part of that, it was so expensive, not because it was recreating the studio, but because of what they had to add just to keep up, because it's a new building.
Yeah.
They had to install all this incredible stuff in terms of
climate control
and special kinds of lighting. I mean, that's where a lot of the cost went into.
And trying to fit it into, you know, a relatively small space. I mean, you're looking at about 1,000 square foot plan, you know, or footprint, but, you know, it's nice tall ceilings, but you need to incorporate all the things that make it a usable, modern, you know, venue for exhibitions and are at the level and standard that you can get major institutions to lend you important paintings like the Architect's Dream.
Mm. Now, when it's not a new production like that, I mean, that was from the ground up.
Mm-hmm.
I assume the requirements aren't as demanding in terms of, you know, codes and things like that.
Yeah, I think code is typically, you know, more of a conversation than something that is, because you're dealing with something that just inherently is not code. So
right.
It's a question of, okay, what's reasonable and what are we trying to accomplish in terms of safety and, you know, which regulations do we really need to adhere to?
I have to interrupt you for a second because even though this conversation is one of the better ones we've had recently, in my opinion, we have to pitch a little bit.
We do.
And we've just shown you the quality of conversation you get on this station.
That's right.
We could have him as a guest frequently, but we won't if you don't support us.
Oh, please do. I want to come
back. No, there might be no station. That's the point.
Yeah. What you do is very important.
Oh, thank you.
We try to let people know what's going on in the cultural world.
And remember, you're
in
Ellen
Columbia.
Thurston.
Yes. And you are Thomas DiPietro.
And that kid behind me is Jake Ebel.
That's right.
And this is a Thursday afternoon show, and we need your support.
And we're here with Peter Watson.
That's right.
Every time I hear your name, I think, is he related to Thomas J. Watson?
No, certainly not. and no connections to Sherlock Holmes or Watson and Crick, DNA or something. Just plain old Peter. It's fine.
So please call in 697-7400. 697-7400. I just read that. You should say it slowly.
697-7400.
Ooh. Yeah, but at the same time, you want
to. It reminds me of Bob and Ray.
Oh, Bob and Ray.
When they used to.
Now they're both gone.
They're both gone?
You didn't see that?
Well, I knew that one.
Ray was long gone. Bob just died recently.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. It was like almost
good
100.
Old radio personalities.
Yeah.
Right.
But they used to talk about the organization called the Slow Talkers. of America. Anyway.
Oh, yes.
But we have to talk fast because we only have half an hour more.
And we need money.
Money.
We need your money. 697-7400. I don't hear the phone ringing. We have so many volunteers out there. Last count was 23, I believe.
Oh, it
waiting.
Seems to have dropped off since
yeah,
then.
Yeah, well, it's only 2 now. But they're waiting for your calls. 697-7400. I'm just saying it because, you know, I'm looking at the guide. I'm trying to figure out what we're doing wrong. And we're not saying the number enough, and we're not saying who we are. I don't know why.
We're not saying 697-7400?
I think we are. But we're also saying WGXC.org, where you can donate online.
Right.
Or, once again, you could always just stop by here at 704 Columbia Street.
And if you come within the next
half hour.
Yeah.
You
could
be
on air.
Yeah. I mean, you're not going to be as interesting as Peter Watson, but, you know, we'll make you interesting. We don't have to do that with him because he is interesting. We pretend to be interesting anyway, ourselves, I mean.
Do you think it fools anybody?
It fools me.
Anyway, call 697-7400.
So,
or come to the big extravaganza party.
Oh, yeah. Friday. That's tomorrow at 7 p.m. at Plus Space, 365 Main Street in Catskill for 40 smackers. You get in, you get some food, you get some drink, you get live music, you get DJs playing, and you get to look at 51 works of art that you can bid on.
Uh-huh.
Bring your checkbook, Ellen. I know there's some things over there you'd like. Some sassy nudes. No. Not really.
Well, we try here to help the good causes of Columbia County and Greene County.
I know, and I just feel bad because they got tons of dough, and we're like sweating it out here.
We are sweating it out. That's true. It's warm in the studio today.
People like to support houses and restoration, I think, don't they?
You mean
tangible.
Their own restoration?
Yeah, that too. But no, it's a tangible thing that you can then, you know, go visit and all that kind of thing.
Right.
You could actually visit here. People don't realize that. They could visit here anytime because we are a community radio station.
Yeah, I think what I've been hearing about in these lectures has been really interesting. I've learned a lot. I don't know all this going. You know, what it takes to restore a building like Plum Bronson.
Yeah, and I think actually the lecture last weekend was a little more straight history. I think the second one on March 12th is really going to be just a little more fun because, you know, Barnabas Waterman is an interesting figure. He was an alderman actually in Hudson, member of the militia.
Like Ellen.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, but the big question is, and he was on building committees for things like the almshouse, which is now the Mid-Hudson Library. But there's a big question, what actual involvement he's had with some of these houses. And, you know, is this all just sort of a product of the colonial revival? And so we're going to really talk about the history, what we know about the historical figure and the myth. But then we're really just going to have a lot of fun. I think, you know, both the Bronson House and the Vanderbilt House have these wonderful elliptical staircases. So we're just going to have some fun looking at the
Bronson
buildings
House
closely,
staircase.
Kind of comparing them, lots of images. And then, you know, a little bit about what we've learned about their evolution with a little help of some computer rendering, which is a personal favorite. If I get a model, I'm happy. But I think it helps you sort of see how they changed over time. And, it's going to be fun. These are really popular history. It's
right.
Not too, you know, not too serious, not too pompous. It's really let's enjoy this incredible heritage that we have. Let's celebrate it. And for our two organizations, it really is to, you know, Columbia County is part and Hudson are connected. Hudson is part of Columbia County. We're trying to get our bases
are
supported.
Seat. We
you
are the county seat.
But, you know, a lot of the things that we find here in Hudson, you know, are connected to other buildings or other places in Kinderhook. And I think seeing them together, you know, and being able to drive and look at one and then look at the other.
You notice that just
very important.
Just walking the streets sometimes, you see little architectural details that suddenly show up in other neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And you just have to assume that they were done at the same time, you know, because somebody was doing
certain
shingle patterns or those little curlicue things. I don't know the names.
You know, and I think on March 12th, you're going to see a lot of fan lights. I mean, there's some wonderful ones down on Lower Warren, the Jenkins houses, the two that sit there. And you look at that leaded glass fan light with a flattened, ellipse. And then, it looks a lot like the Vanderpool house, and it looks a lot like the Bronson house. And so I think some of the fun is really kind of looking for some of the details and thinking about what's the same and what's different and, you know, what are their individual histories?
There you go, folks. Where else can you hear that kind of information? Right here.
Well, we had about 100 people come for the lecture on Saturday, and we were really shocked with, you know, the level of the crowd, the interest in this topic that some people might say, well, who cares? I think a lot of people do, and they're hungry for this, particularly
if it's not
too serious, and it's really about enjoying it and celebrating our wonderful history here in Columbia County.
Do you ever get hired by private homeowners who just want to restore their houses in a historic way?
I don't. I mean, I I've been my own sort of restoration. I mean, what got me into this racket really was my own house, restoring it over the last 15 years. But I don't really work with private homeowners. I leave that to other experts.
Yeah. Now, I know a couple of people do it, and, you know, it's just amazing. Some people go, they'll use authentic insulation for, or try to recreate authentic insulation. They'll actually harvest nails from the period that they're trying to recreate, things like that.
I got a whole, you know, buckets full of nails. I mean, I think the thing that's fun for me is I think it's very interesting, the history side of things, the sociology side of things. The reading the old books is a lot of fun, but I really like participating in the act, being hands-on. And I think you learn a lot by taking apart, like, a cornice and to repair it and understanding how it's built and how the parts and looking at, you know, where the molding plane marks are and having that understanding of what it you know, took to create it.
Do you think it's always essential to use the same materials? I mean, how do you feel about recreating certain, let's say, a cornice with a more durable sort of composite material?
I like wood. mainly because I think it looks, you know, a cornice made out of the synthetic materials looks good in the beginning when you first do it, but it doesn't age the same way that wood does. Mm-hmm. So 5-10 years later, you got kind of this little bit of, you know, if something's wood and something's made out of not wood, you're very aware of it 5 or 10 years later.
My house is insulated with newspapers from the 1930s. It was a barn. And I don't think I would, if I were re-insulating it, that I would use 1930s newspapers.
You know, my house had in the wall, it had an old fire-style insulation. It was the thin brick inside, which is still there now, and a couple other part of it anyway. Huh. Kind of cool.
Yeah, we're all getting really interested in this stuff. Living in Hudson, it's hard not to.
Well, we're surrounded by, you know, old buildings. You know, many of us have lived in or restored old buildings. So I do. I think there's a lot of interest in the topic and nice to sort of think about what's in your house and how it relates to some of the, you know, high style examples that we have as well.
At the lecture, you mentioned a Bard symposium on view sheds to take place in April.
Yeah. So this is at Bard College. It's going to be, I think the new date is April 2nd, and it's a day-long symposium. I believe it's going to be at Montgomery Place, talking really about a landmark act of viewshed preservation. So in 1840, the two owners of these two adjoining estates, that was Louise Livingston of Montgomery Place and Robert Donaldson of Blythewood, both of which are now owned by Bard College, there was a piece of land between them on the Sauk Hill that had been used for sawmills and gristmills. And it was threatened by the owner of that land that he was going to build a factory. So Donaldson wrote Louise Livingston and said, you know, if we kind of come together and buy this, then we can really, you know, make our pleasure grounds be all that they, you know, they can possibly be. And so they purchased essentially, you know, it's a conservation deal. So they bought the land, and then they redeveloped it in this picturesque mode with this wonderful ravine walk, a rustic bridge. And Davis, you know, painted some lovely views, which I showed last weekend, including one that showed him sitting down at the bottom with his easel kind of painting the view. So he's included himself as the artist in the view. So that's sort of the, you know, that's 175 years ago. And so they're celebrating that as really a first act of viewshed preservation, like the subsequent you know, work we've talked about, I'm sure, on your show at Alana, the viewshed.
Oh, yeah.
It's a big piece.
My wife did a lecture on, she led a panel on the famous, how the viewshed prevented cement plant from going in. But it was a really major ruling, so that the Alana viewshed actually, all these years later, prevented a industrial development.
That's right.
And so this is really talking about the roots of that sensibility and really a first act and using that as an opportunity to climb around.
I was reading some Hudson Valley history, and it's amazing, you know, because all the robber barons and before that, even down, I was reading about something in Garrison and how they built all these estates and then suddenly noticed they themselves had kind of denatured a lot of the landscape and then suddenly became highly preservationist. But that happened, you know, pretty much by mid-19th century. They were already thinking of how to preserve the view shed, the landscape.
And certainly people like Thomas Cole were very aware of, you know, what it meant to cut down, you know, majestic trees, and was you know, very early kind of raising the alarm against that. So I think people did understand it. There were a lot less trees because people needed them to, you know, heat their homes. I mean, there was, so you look at these old photos and things that were like at the Mount Lebanon with the Shakers, these ridges were completely open and you could see for miles and miles. And today it's all second growth. So, I mean, you know, that's nature coming back, which it always wants to do if we let it.
Mm-hmm. So this lecture that we've been talking about in Kinderhook on
March 12th, it's at 5 o'clock. It's at the Jack Shaman's The School, and it's the former Martin Van Buren Elementary School from 1929, in itself a fine piece of architecture.
And it's right there on the
It's on 25 Broad Street. It's right in the village there. It's
as you come in from the
If you're coming in from 9, it's just on the other side of the main square there. And the gallery itself will be open from most of the day. I think it's 11 to 5. So it's definitely a nice opportunity to go see the current exhibits. There's one titled Winter in America and another exhibit of photos from the Black Panther era in the 1960s. So I think some very interesting things to see that don't involve architecture. And then go take a look at these two wonderful buildings and have some fun kind of exploring the facts and myths of surrounding Barnabas Waterman and you know, get up close and personal with all these elliptical staircases. And I think we'll have some fun.
Great.
We've been speaking to Peter Watson. And Ellen, can you tell us what his credentials are once again? He's
an architectural historian.
A consultant to the Plum Bronson Project.
And he is also a board member of the Shaker Museum, New Lebanon.
Okay. Is there more?
And I think you write a blog. Don't you write a blog about the progress being made on the Bronson House?
Yeah. I have been keeping a blog called the Dr. Oliver Bronson House Daybook. And Daybook because Davis kept it in Daybook. So, but if it needs some updating. So, I mean, this is going to encourage me to bring it up to date.
Oh, good.
But it talks a little bit about the house and the archaeology projects and the things we've been finding with the work over the past few years. So,
yes, when I was there visiting, you were down in a sort of gully on the side of the house explaining something about was it an old heating system?
Yeah. So, I mean, on the south side of the house, we have a current project. It's a $400,000 EPF grant, and we're going to finish the project hopefully by next July. This is sort of the second season. And as part of that, we've really been trying to learn, you know, what was the original configuration of the servant's entrance? What would the grade look like? And we actually found an original cistern and some remnants of a retaining wall.
That's what I see.
And Matt Kirk from Harkin, who has been my partner in crime with this kind of work for the last few years, he was down there in the ditch, and I was up in the room. And it was great because a lot of people came out on a really cold day. That was an outside venue. So that was archaeology really used to help us learn about how to restore things and also to, in the future, to help tell the story of the house. I mean, we've learned so much over the past few years, and some of that I'm going to try and pull into the lecture as well, because it's fun to see, you know, how this is done and the kind of things you learn from archaeology and paint analysis and those types of projects.
Well, Peter Watson, thanks for coming in. We've been speaking to Peter Watson, and that should tell you what you get on Community Radio. You get interesting local community members who have interesting projects that they'll talk about and introduce you to and let you know what's coming up in the community.